Hello and welcome to another episode of The Meaning of Life and Such. I'm your host, Haya Kamps, and I try to chip away at the question of who we are, why we're all here, and what it all means. If that sounds a little bit vague, then, well, you try coming up with a better description of what this is all about. Notes on a postcard, please. In any case, here's our new deep dive into life, the universe, and everything. Let's roll tape. Welcome to another episode of The Meaning of Life and Such. Today I am joined by one of my favorite authors, and she is a delightful human being all around. Meg, what's your name? What pronouns do you use, and where in the world are you?
So my name is Meg Elison. I use she, her, or they, them. Either is fine. And I am in Oakland, California.
Wonderful, as am I. So I am so psyched to have you on this podcast. There's one question I like to ask people to kind of set a little bit of context, which is, where did we meet, or how did we meet, and what is your first memory of me?
We met in one of the most unusual ways I think I've met anyone that I know. So I love telling this story. Yeah. A friend of mine invited me to a party at somebody else's house, which is, I know, not a germane event in everyone's life, but it actually happens to me a lot. So I showed up to a very fashionable loft full of really cool people and immediately felt like I was outclassed and I was not cool enough to hang out. And I sort of wandered around the party and eventually met my host, which turned out to be you, Haya.
Yep.
And we talked about books and photography and travel and LSD. And I liked you very much at once. And we've been friends in a glancing way, I would say, ever since, although the year of the pandemic certainly didn't help.
Yes. Yeah, I feel like we've been asymptomatic friends. We seem to be getting closer and closer and then never quite touching. It's hilarious.
That's a good way to put it. I mean, things are coming back around for the most part this year, so who knows what the future will bring.
Absolutely. Well, and what I love about this particular party was that this was... So my ex-wife, Zai, and I used to throw these cocktail and portraiture parties. And so I had a full-on photo studio set up. And, you know, I had a couple of barrels of beer. One was homebrew, one was not. We went through all of it. We went through our entire collection of booze that night.
It was a very moist party, yes.
It was a very moist party, indeed. I took portraits of all my friends in various... I think this may have been the ridiculous stock photography party.
It was a stock photography party. So there's a picture of me from this party with my dress open and I'm nursing an electric drill.
I know.
There's a picture of me... There's a picture of me contemplating a pineapple while wearing a sash that I think says I'm the governor of the Dominican Republic.
I believe so.
It's a truly notable strangeness in my photo collection.
I am just so delighted. And I mean, the pandemic clearly got in the way of doing more of these parties. But I love the idea of bringing something of yourself to a party, right? And I am a reasonably good photographer. And so being able to have that as like comedic relief, like having something to do at a party, is just a really fun thing to do.
And I believe in scheduled activities.
People showed up. Like, totally.
Yeah, because if you're just standing around and you don't know how to make friends or what to do, it's not as much fun for anyone.
Yeah.
So having
absolutely
even a game, even we're all going to cook a thing together, or I mean, your plan for a party is excellent. Like stock photography and the weirdness of it really unites everyone. Like there isn't any chance to be unknown or to be awkward. We're all doing the same thing.
Oh, we were all awkward, but we were awkward together.
Exactly. It doesn't feel
it was
half
beautiful.
As bad. It was.
I look forward to being able to do those again. I really wanted that to be like a regular kind of feature of my parties. And you know, if you throw a party sometime, I will happily show up with photo gear. I think it's just such a fun thing to be able to add to it, and it means that I get to be introverted and extroverted at the same time.
Yeah, there are two people who I always trust when I see them coming in the door at a party. One is the person with the guitar and one is the person with the camera. They are both so welcome.
Nice. Love it. So I am really curious, Meg, about... So I think because it's contextually helpful, can you say a little bit about what you do for a living?
Sure. So I am an author, primarily of science fiction, but also of fantasy and horror and contemporary writings. I'm an essayist. I occasionally work as a journalist and I freelance in a number of places. But the bottom line is I make my living by making things up and putting words down. And it is the best job anyone on this earth has ever had.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you run a literary salon, I believe.
I do, although we've not come back from the pandemic yet. I am a producer of a show called Literary Salon, which focuses on the work of women in the Bay Area. And we do live shows with poetry and prose and comedy and burlesque dancing and you name it. Right now, after the shutdown, we lack a venue. So we are working to find a spot where we can put the show on again because I dearly loved it. And I really threw my soul into it and I want to do it again.
Love it. I think all of those things are really helpful to contextualize kind of who you are, not least because as we are slowly encroaching on talking about a little bit of the big questions in life, I feel like a lot of people are really bad at aligning their life mission or life goal, if you have such a thing, with how you spend most of your time. And I feel like you're one of the few people I know who maybe you haven't solved it, but you've at least taken a couple of steps in the right direction.
I would say that that's correct. I think that for most people, it's not a failure on their part that they can't get that working. It's just, it's that it's not an option. And I spent more than a decade treading water in a job that I hated and spending very little time doing what I wanted to do because there wasn't any other option. So I've experienced life both ways. And I believe that that helps me cultivate a daily sense of gratitude and real enjoyment in what I have now because I know what it's like to not have it.
Hmm. And so writers are a funny bunch, but most people write for a reason, right? It's not just that you need to get words down or that you have, but you have a message. You know, there's a couple of red threads that run in your books. It feels like one of them is intersectional feminism. One of them is just different angles into queerness and ways of interacting with human beings. Does that tie in with who you feel you are and what your mission is in life?
Oh, absolutely. I very much write from my own experience. So my experience of being a woman and figuring out what that means and what it's worth to me and watching other people struggle toward womanhood or away from womanhood, it really has informed the kind of art that I want to make. And it comes from the life that I've lived and the things that I've suffered through. And I am old enough to be of the generation of people who got kicked out of the house for being queer. So that is a thing that I have carried with me all my life. And for the most part, being queer has brought me endless joy and put me into the coolest and most cultured social circles anybody could wish for. But it's not without its burden. So, of course, that works its way into what I write. I would also say that I write a great deal about poverty because my earliest experiences were grounded in that way. And it makes for the foundation of my class consciousness and ultimately forms my politics. And, you know, no matter what anybody tells you, your politics make up your art.
Absolutely. Yeah. And are you feeling like you're able to make headway there? Is what you're doing helping you do the things you want to accomplish in life?
So yes, I think that I do make headway because the work that I publish enables people to see me. It enables me to be seen in the way that I had always hoped and the way that I've dreamt of my whole life. And that's priceless. The other thing is that I occasionally, very occasionally, but it's so meaningful when it happens, make headway for someone else. I read all of my fan mail. I'm very interested in it. And every once in a while, I get a letter from someone who tells me that I changed their mind, that I helped them accept their own queerness or the queerness of someone near them, or to see the inside of a story that they had only seen previously from the outside. And that's immeasurably valuable to me. That's what I think every artist hopes, is that they'll change someone's mind, even if just once.
Yeah. And the fact that you've experienced that, do you're like, okay, cool, my work here is done. I can go do something else, or... Are there more minds that need changing?
There are always more minds that need changing. And I think dissatisfaction is a human trait. I don't think anybody who reaches satisfaction or a sense of a balanced self or a sense of accomplishment and has it last, like, these things don't last. Like, people who win the French Open and the Nobel Prize and the gold medal, they don't hang it up and then quit they go back every right. year until they're too old to do it because we're never satisfied. And I'm no different. I'm never satisfied. I always want to change more minds, write more books.
Yeah. I also feel like the moment of satisfaction, though, is by necessity fleeting. Like if you sat anybody down and said, hey, what was the most satisfying moment you ever had in your life, right? For a lot of people, that is like, oh, that was that one time I had this orgasm with this one person. But the thought of living your life in like straight up orgasm for the rest of your life sounds like agony, right? That's not nice.
No, it does sound like agony. It also, I also think it would devalue that state. Like eventually, if you got used to it, like it's only so good because it takes work to get there and it's over so quickly. It's like yeah. if we were always sliding downhill and we never had to climb up, like eventually it would lose its novelty. It would cease to thrill you. So part of it has to be earning it.
And so I feel like that in itself means that life is cyclical, right? If we agree for a moment that you cannot stay in that blissed out space forever. I mean, I've definitely had sessions of meditation where I was in the kind of like, oh yeah, I am in deep peace now. And I have been for 40 minutes, but 40 minutes is a stretch.
40 minutes is, I mean, longer than most people can get out of anything resembling perfection. That is master level shit right there. I would say most of my greatest moments of satisfaction have lasted less than an hour, much less. Yeah.
And so I guess that takes us to, we have the cyclical nature of life. And so, you know, there are the peaks, but there's also the satisfaction of working towards a peak. What is the eye? What is the eye that is doing that climbing for you?
Ooh, that is something I struggle with in myself and in my work all the time, because the answer that I come back to that I can prove is not one that I find ennobling or satisfying. The eye, as far as I'm concerned, is the body. And the body is inseparable from the mind, the soul. I never feel as though the body is a vehicle, or that my true self is a brain in a jar, or that I am some kind of spiritual being that is temporarily trapped in all this meat. Everything good that happens to me happens in my body. Everything bad, the score is kept here. Everything I achieve, I do with it. I have a lumpy handful of gelatin with neurons firing in it in the pan of a bone bowl. Like, it's all frighteningly concrete and it's all falling apart and it all runs on a pump the size of my fist, which is just ludicrous when you think about it. But it's also
really poor design.
It's terrible design. And it's only going to last like 70 years. And
right.
when I get right down to the center of that, it makes me panic because I know this can't last. It's too pink and too soft. It's not going to last.
Yeah.
But it is the eye.
I'm a skeleton wearing a meat suit. Now what?
That's it. And I dream of star stuff. And I write stories about people on spaceships. Like, there is no part of this life that is not absurd.
Mm-hmm. But it feels, from the way you're talking about it, it feels like you've embraced that absurdity and you're actually enjoying it.
I don't think there's any other way. I think denying absurdity or trying to construct meaning that eludes absurdity, or lending yourself some fable of importance that distracts you from absurdity, is ultimately folly. And I think it leads to greater pain. I think connecting with that sense of absurdity and admitting to others, like, gosh, what you're going through is just ridiculous, it gives me a great deal of comfort, because it absolves any exterior focus or exterior hierarchy that's supposed to keep things running the way they're supposed to go. There is no supposed to. There are no rules. No one is keeping track. This is just the absurdity we live.
There's a thing in there. I had this kind of daydream the other day.
What? You? Never.
Where I decided that my next tattoo is going to be saying, it's a good job tattoos aren't permanent. Because for one thing, it's hilarious on the surface of it. But on the other hand, I'm like, no, human bodies are impermanent, right?
Right.
If you think that anything you draw on your body is permanent, you haven't understood
the
timelines.
Anyone who's ever lectured me about a tattoo or looked at it and said, gosh, you know, that's permanent, I say, is it?
Yeah, exactly.
I think you've mystified the word. Do you know?
Yeah, I feel like in 100 years, this is not going to bother anybody.
No, it won't exist anymore. It's going to crumble and hopefully be eaten by insects. Like, it's very biodegradable and it's extremely temporary. Do you listen to Amanda Palmer at all?
I have on occasion.
She has a song that I love that never fails to make me cry, and there's a snatch of lyrics in the middle of it that says, "When they put me in the ground, I'll start pounding the lid, saying that I haven't finished yet. I still have a tattoo to get that says I'm living in the moment."
Oh, that's so on the nose.
Right?
Oh, I love it.
Me too.
Oh my God, I love it. That makes me so happy. But yeah, I feel like the impermanence of all of this is one of the vectors that people have towards thinking about, you know, why are we here?
Right.
It's like, you know, I like to think of life as a sexually transmitted disease.
It is. It's true. It's the classic.
Yeah. And I like to also think of life as something very impermanent. You know, most of us won't make it out alive.
Right.
And there's a relief in that. You know, there is a, you know, no matter how bad or how good it gets, there's like an end, which is interesting. But in that period of life, we do a bunch of stuff that is deeply inspiring.
Right.
Right. Even the most mundane shit can be inspiring, but a lot of us don't actually have mundane lives. And I wonder, I ask this question of a lot of my guests and a lot of people in life in general, but I feel like it's a particularly interesting one for you, which is, where do ideas come from?
Oh, I think there are a couple of answers to that. I don't think there's any one place. One of my favorite places that ideas come from is from other art. I think most art is made of other art, except for the first art. Whoever managed to pull that off, hats off to them.
Right.
But I, as an author, I find myself reading a lot of other people's work, living and dead, and looking at it and thinking, how would I do this differently? If it sucks, how do I do it better? If it's great, how do I do something that's so far from its lane that I'll never be compared to them ever?
Right.
That's a huge source for me. I'm inspired by the art of others. I think ideas often come from the subconscious, which is a flighty, untrustworthy thing. But I very often come up with story ideas in dreams or in a near dreaming state. And I know that something planted the idea there, that it's not really original, that it's something I watched on television when I was 6 years old and it's been buried ever since, but who knows. But usually your subconscious will remix those constituents until they're unrecognizable, and that's when people start telling you you're original, which is great. And then,
cool, thanks.
I think that there are practical ways that you can prod yourself into producing ideas, and one of these ways is there are games. There's the what if game, you know. What if we rode around on armored polar bears and sought glory in battle? Or the can you game, like, can you write a superhero story where the hero in question can stop that condominium collapse in Miami, and how would they pull it off, and can you save those people?
It's a building inspector with a cape, basically.
Right? It's a well-regulated real estate business, but with a hat on. Like, yeah.
It's a functioning government. Ugh, we can but dream.
The greatest of all fantasies, dear heart.
Funny because it's true.
Indeed, we're living in a failing state with no real infrastructure. Mazel tov.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Anyway, on that note, do you find inspiration? I think you already answered this, but I kind of want to ask it again because I thought it was fascinating. Do you find inspiration in art of other forms, i.e., not writing, music, picture art?
I tell would-be writers all the time. First of all, you're not reading enough. None of you are. I'm not either. It's okay. But also, it is very easy to get stuck in a rut and to focus on authors who intimidate you or authors who inspire you and lose track of everything else. So it's really great to get out and absorb art in other forms. I love going to museums and looking at visual art. That is, it has such a recharge facility for me because it doesn't ask anything of me as an artist. It gives and it gives and it gives. It feels like I'm filling a pitcher. I listen to music constantly. I listen to different music as much as I possibly can to get exposed to new things. And I also listen to favorites. When I'm writing something, I often listen to one piece over and over and over, which can be stultifying, but it also reveals depths. And I love getting out and doing things again with the body, but often in an artistic fashion because it feels like giving back to the instrument that gives everything up. So getting out and dancing is probably my greatest form of release. But also, you know, going to the park and doing Tai Chi, or learning a new yoga pose, like any kind of art you can make with your body, I feel like gives back to the body that makes art.
Yeah, and I very strongly agree with that. Recently, I've been on a binge of listening to music in languages I don't understand, which has been so wonderful. Lots of African languages, lots of Asian languages. And it's been really kind of freeing, because the reducing lyrics to a musical instrument is really quite wonderful. And I mean, similarly, you can only read the first third of Infinite Jest so many times before you decide that that's not the book for you.
It's true. Do you know that song? It's by a famous Italian artist. He recorded it, I think, in the 60s or 70s. It's called Prison Colon in Sanancuso.
Is that the one that sounds like English sounds to other people?
It's made up of English phonemes, but it's not real English. But the fascinating thing about it is that it still manages to have the exact cadence and resonance of an English pop song, even though it's not real words. It's such a fascinating exercise, both linguistically and culturally. And when I'm fed up with trying to make sense of something, I often go listen to it. I feel like it's a great palette.
Yeah, I know the song well, and there's something about it that really reaches into the uncanny for me.
Yes.
Like, I've definitely been stoned enough to not understand words.
Right.
And I'm like, oh, this is, I know this feeling, but I'm stone cold sober and these musicians are assholes.
Right. It's just the Inigata Devita problem.
Yes.
I like that. Is it Santelato? I feel like that's his name. Anyway, I like that he synthesized both that experience as well as the experience of living in a world with a dominant language for popular music is maybe a language that you don't speak. Like, imagine waking up in a world where, we're nearly there, but like, what if K-pop bands really did take over and like all the music you listen to is now Korean? If you don't speak Korean, you're going to have a fundamentally different experience of it than everybody else.
Yeah. Well, I remember that when I was a kid, and then I think we were listening to the Beatles, maybe? And I was like, Mom, can you translate this? She goes, I don't know. I don't speak English well enough. And I was like, so why do you listen to it? And I mean, it's the fucking Beatles. That's why you listen to it. But right. Also, there is a thing in there where you're like, wait, it's not a... Yes, the lyrics help. And I mean, let's be honest, a lot of Beatles lyrics are extremely vapid.
A lot of times, especially the early stuff.
But that was how they found their feet and took inspiration from all sorts of things and kind of moved into a direction that made more sense for them. And I feel like that's true for a lot of artists. You know, if I read my early writings or if I look at my early stuff, I'm like, okay, I can see what I was trying to do here.
Yes.
And
it's okay to start somewhere. I mean, it's okay to start off imitative. And the Beatles certainly were. They were, for the most part, imitating artists of color. And also to start off with your school friends and see when the stakes are off, when there's no heat, when there's no audience, what can you do? And it's also okay to grow as an artist as you do that. And they certainly grew in ways that were appropriative and exploitative, but they did it in a world that was open to that. And it's not unproblematic, but I do think it lent them greatness. So we're privileged to be able to see that entire evolution.
Well, I think there's the old, surgery thing, right? Which is watch one, do one, teach one. I feel like that is really helpful for creative exploits as well. With my photography students, I'm often like, look, can you go and find me a photo that you really like and tell me why you like it? And then let's recreate it as closely as we possibly can, whether in spirit, whether in color, whether in setting, whether in whatever it is, let's recreate it. And they're like, yeah, but then I'm just copying. I'm just like, yeah, but you're going to be learning a fuck ton about how to take this photo while you copy it.
That's exactly it.
And then
it.
The second photo you take can be completely your own, but you use the same techniques.
I do the same thing. I mean, I did the same thing as a writer, and I think a lot of writers do. Most of us imitate another author who we really love until we find our own voice. And by imitating, you learn how they construct their sentences. You learn what makes up their voice. And it's really difficult to recognize your own voice and to cultivate it. But seeing it in other people makes you better at it. So I spent years sounding like Oscar Wilde, and then sounding like Margaret Atwood, and then sounding like Chuck Palahniuk. Like, these are just the steps we have to take to become good.
Yeah. Well, I went through a very similar route with Douglas Adams. Everything I wrote was just very complicated sentences, hilarity for no reason, and lots of non-sequiturs. But I was like, you know what? I like reading this shit. It doesn't matter that the story isn't actually that great. Just the language, just the juiciness of having to reread a sentence because you're like, I did not know where that was going. It makes me so happy.
He has an incredible voice, and he is a great example of an author to take apart if you want to learn how voice works.
Mm. Yeah, for sure, for sure.
Yeah.
And I think Terry Pratchett has a similar kind of approach to it as well.
Very similar.
I feel like they're extremely kind of interchangeable for lots of reasons. You know, one of them did it for sci-fi, the other did it for fantasy. But I feel like there's a beautiful, like, way of looking at those two authors. Like, okay, they're parodies, but they're also moving that genre forward, which is kind of wild.
Yeah, it is. And they're both deeply British with a very dry British sense of humor. They both have a certain irreverence or irreligious bent, which I think makes them sort of deliciously funny when opposed to convention. They're both great at being unconventional.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. So, steering us slightly back onto the... It's funny, I feel a little bad because even in my introduction, I'm kind of defining you as an author, and that is not the point of this podcast. You know, you are so much more as a human being than just your job.
Sure.
And I would hate to be reduced to what I do for a living. So I apologize for that. I guess one question I could ask you that would be interesting is, like, how do you make one decision over another?
Hmm. I think that I try to think things through as far as possible. I try to project outcomes and imagine what will come of this decision. And of course, you can't ever really predict, and there are forces outside your control that you can do nothing about. But everything within my control and everything that I know I have to interact with on the other side of the decision is, for the most part, pretty predictable. Like, my life is not so wild and crazy that I can't see where things are going to go. I wouldn't say that I'm...
If that is...
Say again?
What a gift that is.
Yeah, no, it definitely is. Like, there's a bit in the Bible, in the book of Job, where one of the blessings that Job receives is that today will be like unto the morrow. You know where you'll be from day to day. When I was a kid, I thought that sounded like a death sentence.
Right.
And now that I'm old enough to appreciate, you know, constancy, being able to know what's going to happen when I walk into a Starbucks, it's you can't knock it, you know?
Yeah. Well, and it goes deeper than that, right? You can predict that, you know, weird shit happens, but your electricity is probably going to be on tomorrow.
Right.
You know, your alarm clock is probably going to go off.
Right.
If you go to the supermarket, there's probably going to be avocados and limes. You know, there's some things that are predictable, which you don't have to be that many degrees separated or that many countries away from here where those things aren't givens. And that type of boredom is beautiful.
It is. It is a huge privilege. Like, the ability to be bored by the consistency and the riches around you, I think, is one of the ones we take for granted all the time. And since I've lived in such extreme poverty, since I've been unhoused and food insecure, like, I never take that for granted. Like, the idea that the electricity will definitely be on tomorrow is a golden, wonderful thing.
Do you feel that as like a trauma, or do you feel like protective about making sure it stays that way in any way?
I do feel somewhat protective. I am motivated by the knowledge of how bad things can get, how quickly that can happen. But I wouldn't say that it holds all that much trauma for me anymore. It's something that I've worked really hard to work through. And it is one of the great things about making art is that you can put your trauma in it and work your way through it and see it from another angle. And God, is that beautiful. So I wouldn't say that I'm motivated all that much by fear of returning to that state, but it did instill in me a deep and pervasive need to own a home, which is such a fucking American thing, but still, and it's nagging at me all the time now.
Oh, so you haven't yet?
No, I never have.
Yeah, and I mean, I was recently on a path towards trying to buy something in the Bay Area, and I was, I don't know, it's very easy to get, and I mean, we're talking about this like two ridiculously privileged humans in the grand scheme of things. And that struggle was really quite painful, like realizing that the even the basic things I wanted weren't within my price range.
Yeah.
And, you know, you could move to somewhere else, but then I wouldn't be in the hotbed of hippie, wonderful, crazy, poly weirdness.
Right. There's that I love being in. Much to give up. Like every time I look at another city, I think I'm trading the entire Pacific Ocean for this. I'm trading a group of people who are unmatched in talent and interest in culture for this. I'm trading the 4 or 5 literary events I go to every month for this. And it makes homeownership look really small.
Yeah. Well, and that is, again, goes back to the how you make decisions, you know? I feel like for me, how you make decisions is very closely tied to the I. It's like, I need to know who I am. Next, I need to know what my North Star is. And between those two things, I can maybe map out some decisions that kind of make sense.
If we return to the concept of the I, if I am making my decisions based on knowing myself and knowing who I am, which is where I try to start, the interesting thing about the body is it won't always tell you when the answer is right. The body holds most right answers as basically equivalent. One is not that much better than the other. There is, of course, the outlier that makes your heart absolutely leap, but for the most part, your body will accept, okay. However, it does go off like a fucking fire alarm when the answer is wrong. I have never had my body lie to me about an answer, even long-term planning, even highly intellectual stuff. I can feel it. Like when I used to say to myself that I'm never going to go back to college. I did, in fact, go back to college. But every time I said that, I had this awful grinding feeling in my belly, like I was giving up some irreplaceable part of me. And I don't know how the body knows that, but it knows.
Mm. And so, and forgive me and tell me to bugger off if you don't want to answer this question. Sure. How does that feel in your body? Like, you are choosing between buying your dream home in Tulsa, Oklahoma.
Yes.
Or continuing to rent in the Bay Area. And, you know, you're trying on for size. What would it feel like to move to Oklahoma? What happens in your body at that exact moment?
So I'm listening hard for that no, right? So I ask myself, if you never come home again and smell the bay, would that be okay? And the body doesn't say no. The body says, it's kind of sad, but it's fine. And then if I ask myself, if you never own a home, how does it feel? And the body feels like shit. So I get the stronger no from the second thing. While I know that I will miss being here, and I mean deeply miss, I just got off an airplane on Monday morning, and just the taste of the air, just the round, wet wonder of the marine layer filling your lungs as you get off the gangway cannot be overstated. No part of it can. But it's not everything. It's a lot, but it's not everything.
And it's even gotten to the point of, you know, I get off at 16th Street BART and I can smell the urine from as soon as you step off the bar. And I'm like, you know what? Fuck you, San Francisco. But also, it's kind of part of it. You know, I know that my next steps are going to be to walk across the road to go to El Farolito and eat a greasy ass burrito. But it's just one of those things. I feel like if they cleaned up that BART station, those burritos wouldn't taste as good.
Wouldn't be the same. It's like terroir for wine. Like,
I hope they use that as their slogan.
Featuring the terroir of the Mission. But like, your wine wouldn't be the same if there weren't cows shitting in a river 60 miles north, or, you know, if there wasn't the ash from 1,000 forest fires in the dirt. Like, one of the great things about San Francisco is how dirty and terrible it is. Like, it doesn't amuse me that people live on the street in pain, in addiction, without any better recourse. I mean, with a long and ongoing human waste problem. That's not amusing. It is amusing to me that billionaires have to walk through their offices through it. It's like living in a fucking Fellini film.
Yeah, no, totally. And that feels ever so real.
Yeah.
But I guess, against that backdrop, you know, you have felt in your body the hell no to not owning property.
Yes.
And you felt the glorious air of stepping off an airplane at SFO.
Yeah.
Jet fuel and all.
Mm-hmm.
Why haven't you left yet? I mean, I don't want you to. I'd prefer to keep you here, but I feel like you have it feels like you have clarity there.
I do have clarity. And like all things, it is a major change and it requires a decent amount of preparation. So I am on a road to it. It just hasn't happened yet.
Mm-hmm. Humans have such incredible inertia.
We do. It's so easy to settle.
Yeah, and at some point, I mean, I feel like that about relationships. I feel like that about, I mean, I have a handful of passports. I've lived on many continents. Like, wherever you are, it's easier to stay than to leave. And at some point, something comes up where you're just like, you know what? There is something about the place I want to go to that has a different or bigger allure than where I am now.
Right.
And I think I mentioned this at a previous episode of this podcast, where I recently had a moment where, you know, my divorce finalized. I was working remotely. I didn't have any particular reason to stay here. And I took a really hard look at my life. And I was like, okay, Haya, you can go anywhere in the world. You have a little bit of savings. You can afford a ticket. You can go anywhere in the world. Where are you going to go? And I took a hard look at the Bay Area and the people in it in particular. And I was like, you know what?
Mm.
I'm going to stick it out here for a while.
It really is. It's people. Like, all of my best friends are here. Not all, but many of my partners are here. All of the people who have worked to put me in connection with the next cool thing in my career are here. Like, it's really hard to walk away from. Even being stuck in my house for a year was better here than a lot of other places in the world. Like, we endured a terrible fire season, but we also have both mild summers and mild winters, so being trapped at home wasn't that bad.
Yeah, and I think that's the other piece, you know, the people who kind of weathered a pandemic in, I don't know, Minnesota, had a very different experience than we do, because you can't really spend time outside. You can't go and hang out in your backyard with your right. people unless you wear like 17 parkas and 3 hats.
We had months and months we could catch a drink outside, get coffee outside, go for long walks yeah. outside.
Well, and in fact, we did. And I that's one of the things I was really grateful for, of spending some time even with people who are peripherally in my life, because right. that energy of just, I love community. I love humans connecting as humans and mm-hmm. sharing weird and wonderful ideas with each other. And say what you will about Zoom, but no.
No, it's not at all the same. And not even long, I think 3 or 4 weeks into quarantine, I realized how much I missed interacting with strangers and how much that brought to my life. Just the speech patterns of someone you don't talk to every day, or the way someone's gaze falls on you when they don't know you yet. Like, all of that was much more important to me than I knew.
And so now that you know that, has that changed anything in you?
It definitely made me... It helped galvanize me toward concrete plans when I was vaccinated and when events started to happen again. I don't miss much. I don't stay home. I'm very outgoing and very social. Usually if I get invited to something, I'll go. But mm-hmm. I am more convinced than ever that Netflix and chill is overrated.
Right.
And more.
Yeah, we had a chance at that.
We did. We tried it out. We gave it our best possible shot. It is over.
Yeah. Yeah.
So now I find myself saying yes to absolutely everything, so that I have these incredibly stacked days and weeks. I have a lot of domestic travel to look forward to over the summer. I've said yes to mm-hmm. conventions and appearances and readings and bookstores, and just, I want to say yes to everything. I feel like I lost a year of my life, and there's no getting that back. And I just have to live harder and weirder this next year or two to make up for it.
Oh man, I am looking forward to witness that. I feel like we tried Netflix and chill. We tried Disney Plus and ketamine. Now we have to try something slightly more social.
Yeah, it's Hunter S. Thompson on the road to Vegas. Like, we're I'm up for everything at this point.
Fucking ludes, man.
Fucking ludes. We're somewhere out of Barstow.
Oh my god, I love that film. It is so dark.
Man, in the depths of an Easter bender.
I mean, it is the absurd, it is the bizarre, just kind of amplified up and just thrown in your face.
Yeah.
I was talking to somebody else about Requiem for a Dream the other day, and how I've seen that film exactly once, bought it on DVD, and then left it in the cellophane because I was like, you know what, I cannot face watching this film ever again. But it was so important to me that I had to buy the DVD, and I recommend it to people on the regular, but I'm also like, nope, never need to see that again.
No, it does not bear rewatching. It is such a pure portrait of human misery. There are a number of movies I won't watch a second time. I won't ever rewatch Trainspotting either. I'm good.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And I'm a champion rewatcher. Like, when that meme went around of movies you've watched more than 5 times, I could have done that 10 times over. I rewatch everything, but not the stuff that makes me terribly uncomfortable.
What's your number one rewatched?
Anti-Mame.
Which I have never seen.
Oh, it's so good. It's from, I want to say 1953 or 54. It's adapted straight from a stage play, and you can absolutely tell. It's about a little boy who's orphaned, who goes to live with his unmarried aunt in New York, who's something of a bohemian libertine.
Uh-huh.
And the ways in which she opens doors.
Sounds like my
for
people.
Him. It's exactly the life that I wished I had as a kid. It is spectacular. It's very dated. It's very much of its time. And there is a Japanese butler whose part in the play is extremely reductive and racist. But I will say, I looked up the actor who plays him in the movie is Yuki Shimoda, who was interned as a child and then later went on to be part of the cast for Farewell to Manzanar and had just a spectacular career in Hollywood that he must have fought so hard for.
Mm.
Anyway, it's a great movie with excellent costumes. And the author of the book that it's based on was closeted gay most of his life.
Mm-hmm.
So there are always gay characters in the piece, although very rarely the central character. And he, too, has a really interesting life story. He was, for a time, the personal butler to Ray Kroc, the founder of McDonald's. I know.
Yeah.
I know. It's such a weird story. So, like, I think he was probably in love with Kroc. But no one really knows. He just kind of like dropped off the radar and lived in this guy's foot locker.
Oh my God. I love these kind of like what really happened there stories.
Me too.
Ugh, so beautiful. Ah, Meg, I could talk for hours, but we have already talked for almost an hour. So I want to continue this conversation over many pints at some point.
Absolutely.
But what I do want to finish on is, do you have like a mantra or a guiding principle or something that you keep coming back to when the going gets hard, when the shit hits the fan, where you're like, you know what, fuck everything. Like, is there something that keeps you going?
It's not one thing. I have a handful of those things. Mm-hmm. It would be great if I had a central touchstone, but the truth is I'm a creature of variety. So I have a sign that hangs above my writing desk that says a word after a word after a word is power. That's a Margaret Atwood quote. I always come back to it. It's always like, if you can do nothing else, you can string a word after a word, even if, you know, they chop off your fingers. You can dictate to your phone. It's going to be fine. I have a tattoo on my right elbow from a Stephen King epic fantasy that I have loved my whole life. That says Ka is a wheel, and Ka refers to both fate and soul and your part in the great tapestry of life. And that is to say, it always comes around. It always rhymes with itself.
Yeah. That's wonderful.
There's also a song I listen to, and I'm very sparing with this. I only listen to it when I mean it. But Ravel's Bolero. It is as good as a spell for making me feel like I am able to rebuild myself. So I use it
so good.
Exceedingly sparingly, but when I need it, it's there for me. And there's so much in it. There's so much in it that's martial and hopeful and surreal and organic, but also ticking like a clock. And everything I need is in it.
Oh, that's so good. I have a song like that too, but
what's yours?
I don't want to mention it. I don't want to mention it on the podcast. It's okay. My personal little thing. I'll tell you after.
I'd love that.
But yeah, I feel like it's a break open glass in case I need to sob like a baby for a few minutes kind of song.
Yes.
And that is a powerful thing to have. You know that if you need it, it's a button press away. Spotify can help you out.
Yes.
And then it's just catharsis in a 8-minute thing. It's so good.
I've always thought about it as a form of magic. I've always thought of it as it's a spell that someone wrote a long time ago, and if you keep it bottled up, it stays potent.
Yeah, not as oxidation bullshit.
Nope.
Oh, Meg, it's been so wonderful to talk to you. Thank you so much. I feel full and warm and happy.
Those are good feelings. Again, back to the body. ¶¶